Today's edition of the Daily Daily Caller podcast is brought to you by Ancient Life Oil.
What is full spectrum CBD? Full spectrum CBD is all the cannabinoids, which in turn gives you major effectiveness. CBD isolate is much less effective than full spectrum CBD. No herbicides, no pesticides, pure organic, non-GMO, full spectrum CBD. Where do you get the good stuff? At ancientlifeoil.com. That's ancientlifeoil.com. Buy CBD tinctures that work. That's ancientlifeoil.com.
Alrighty, hello again, everyone, and welcome to it. It's the Daily Daily Caller podcast for the 6th day of March 2019. It's a Friday. Friday is upon us, and thank the maker, it is here. Need another Friday. What a week it has been. A lot of shakeups. The Democrats are pretty much, you know, for down to a two-man race, a two-old man race, a two-old rich white man race. That's what we're dealing with. And Bailey makes her first appearance on the podcast today. Let's see if we can get her to talk. Hey, Bailey, can you say anything? Well, there you go. And Quinn is here as well. Say hello, Quinn. All right. I've taught you both very well. They're, you know, 15 and 16, respectively. Bailey, all right, one more time. Say something.
Just
sticking your face to it doesn't do it. Swatting at it doesn't either. All right. But Quinn, are you going to speak? Are you going to say anything? All right. Programming error on my part. I am Derek Hunter. I am your host. Welcome to the Friday interview edition of the Daily Daily Caller podcast. We'll be talking with Matt Walsh about his new book, Church of Cowards, shortly. But before we get to that, we'll do a quick summary assessment of the news of the last 24 hours before you get to the finding out. And at the end of the show, after the interview, you'll find out if you want a signed copy of the book. There are two to give away. Two. Zwei auf Deutsch, of Yuval Levin's book from last week's interview. Elizabeth Warren called it a day. Elizabeth Warren dropped out of the race. Not really surprising. I mean, I don't understand what took her so damn long. I guess she ended up crying in her driveway, so maybe it was an emotional choice for her, which, I don't know, ladies, sorry, but if you're trying to say that you're strong enough and women can do anything and then you break down and cry when you leave the race, it's not a good look when you get all emotional. Just saying. But she's gone, and most shockingly of the whole thing is that she did not either deuce or get off the pot. She didn't endorse Bernie. She didn't endorse Biden. She says she needs more time to figure it out. So that just lets me know that she's really all about herself. If she believed about the cause, the only person left in the race that is advocating the cause that she advocated, the causes she advocated for, is Bernie Sanders. So there should be no question about that. If she was full of crap the whole time and interested in her own future and viability and wanted to make a trade, I'm sure Joe Biden was offering a better deal. She took neither because she's still convinced that somehow some weird thing is going to happen, that, you know, I don't know, Bernie and Biden will get caught up in sex scandals or one sex scandal together with each other, which actually might help them with the Democratic race. Who knows? But she's a nut job. She's a basket case. And it's not surprising. I guess it's a little bit surprising. She'll be missed in any event, is what I'm saying, because who will condescend to everybody now out there? Because now you've got somebody who just berates people and yells at them. Actually, both Biden and Sanders mistake volume for passion. I don't understand how that works. The louder I talk, the more I care. Well, please hate me and whisper, okay? I'm content with that. Bernie Sanders holds most of the country in contempt, most people in contempt, everybody who doesn't agree with him in contempt, and Joe Biden just wants to hold everybody. It's weird. You've got anger versus senility in the battle of the nursing homes. So congratulations, Democrats. Your celebrated bat back patting about how wonderfully diverse you guys are and how your youth taking over the country has completely been kneecapped. Your own galooly. You took yourselves out. You got a white guy who's 78 and a communist, or a white guy who's 77 and confused. Hell of a choice. Great job. That's the best they can do. I get that Obama decimated the Democratic Party. They lost 1,000 seats across the country during his 2 terms as president. But damn, you had 4 years to find somebody. You come up with nothing. This is what you got? Let me pull this rabbit out of my hat. Yeah, it's a dead rabbit. It's an old dead rabbit. It smells like guacamole and paprika. But it's a rabbit, nonetheless. Too bad. Oh, well. On to beating either one of them in November. Before we get to the interview again, let's just give a hat tip to our sponsor, CBD oil from ancientlifeoil.com. Yes, I use the CBD oil from ancientlifeoil.com. It is sitting right underneath my computer right now. I have it still in the box. Well, it's not. The box has been open, but I store it in the box so the kids don't want to get it. It is the chocolate mint 1 ounce, 30 milliliter, 250 milligram CBD oil. It is simply the best CBD oil available on the market. 100% organic, no THC. You're not going to go get high off of this stuff, but you will feel better. Those little aches and pains will go away. My eye strain goes away. Any anxiety you have, it'll help you sleep. You go to ancientlifeoil.com, all one word. Enter promo code Derek, D-E-R-E-K, at checkout. Click apply, and you get all kinds of special deals just for you guys. It lets them know you heard it here. It lets them know that they should keep supporting here. And they support here. You support here. I support you. We all support each other. We are two. Good job, Derek. We are three legs on a tripod. AncientLifeOil.com. Check it out. All kinds of great products there. Bailey, do not try and lift that weight. It's only 5 pounds, but you're barely 10. Anyway, yeah, my daughter's going to crush herself with a 5-pound weight of my wife's. Because I can lift more than 5 pounds. I'm tougher than that. I'm not insecure at all. Anyway, let's just get on with the news, or the interview, shall we? It's Friday. You guys want to start your weekend? Go ahead and start drinking. Even though I know many of you listen to this in the morning. Have a little beer for breakfast. What the hell? And afterwards, I will announce the winners of the 2 signed copies of Yuval Levin's book. But without any further ado, author of the new book, Church of Cowards, and the host, oddly enough, again, one of those appropriately named podcasts, of the Matt Walsh Show. Bailey, just that's as good a time as any to throw your arms up to the air. Sky and scream. Without any further ado or interruptions, as I get down, my kids. I don't know if I'm encouraging people with this to have kids or discouraging people with this to have kids. All right, just calm. Anyway, without any further interruptions, since the ado is a done, here is the Matt Walsh interview. Alrighty, hello again, everyone, and welcome to it. It's the Daily Caller Podcast, the Friday video interview edition. And as we do every Friday that we can, we rope somebody hog time, drag them in here to pick their brains, to learn from them, hopefully help them sell books if they got a book to do, plug a website, whatever it is. But they have to bring something impressive to the table, and this is no different. We are joined by Matt Walsh. He is the author of the new book, Church of Cowards, A Wake-Up Call to Complacent Christians. And he's also a podcast host, a man of all trades. Welcome to the show. Thanks for coming
in. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Appreciate it. Congratulations on the new book. Before you have any discussion of faith, I find it important to understand what the person you're interviewing with means, what faith means to them. Because it's a bad analogy, but it's apt. It's a lot like pain or food. You say, oh, it felt like my finger was bent back. I know what that feels like to me, but there's no way for me to know what that feels like to you.
Sure.
We have a vague idea. And faith, everybody kind of has this general sense of what it means. But when you write a book about it and the topic that you write about, you need to know what it means to you to frame it properly. So what does faith actually mean to you?
Yeah, that's one thing, and I agree with you, and I think it's a good point. And I talk about that in the book a little bit because I You know, these days we tend to conflate faith and belief. Mm-hmm. So we say that to have faith is to believe, to affirm, you know, to intellectually assent to certain propositions like there is a God and Jesus is Lord and Savior. I think that's just the starting point of faith. I think faith is more than that. I think faith is something that you do. I think it's an act. It's a lot like love. You know, love also is, of course, more than an emotion. You say you love your wife, it doesn't mean that you just feel a certain way about her. It means it's about what you do, the sacrifices that you make for her. So I would say that faith is that. It's sort of the act of walking, in case of Christianity, it's the act of walking, picking up your cross and walking with Christ.
It's living your beliefs.
Right, in a way. Exactly, yeah.
And that, because there are a lot of people, and I've heard you speak on this in my research, 80% are Christian country, even though we're not officially a Christian country. Calm down, Bernie Sanders. But that doesn't necessarily, like, it's an easy box to check. Yeah, I believe God. Okay, yeah, I believe in Jesus, and that's it. Like, I celebrate Christmas. I get the Easter Bunny and all of that. And to that, to many people in this country, and to too many people, depending on how you want to take it, either way, in this country, that constitutes their faith. So when you're dealing with a subject of complacency when it comes to Christianity, you're preaching to an audience. I don't know. Are you trying to preach to the people who don't realize that they are complacent, or are you trying to reach the people who are not, and sort of codify around them? Where are you targeting with this?
Well, I hope both.
Well, obviously, everybody should buy the book.
Yeah, yeah. Atheists. I mean, everyone.
That's right.
Muslims, go ahead.
Bernie, get it.
Yes, everyone, go please buy the book. But, you know, this is, I guess, part of the point of the book is that I think all of us as Christians, myself included, have fallen into complacency, generally speaking. And that's part of the great challenge that we face in our faith. If you compare Christianity in the West to Christianity in other regions of the world, in the Middle East and parts of Africa and Asia, North Korea, you know, there's a very real persecution, a bloody, violent North Korea that's sending Christians to concentration camps, even though you don't hear about it in the media. We don't face that. You know, in this country, we can, as Christians, basically, without fear, go to church, live our lives, proclaim our faith if we want to. Worst thing we'll face is maybe weird looks or frowny face emojis on Facebook or something. And yet, what we find, not in spite of that, but in some ways because of that, the faith is dwindling here. And I think it's because we've gotten so comfortable that we're just riding the waves of the culture and going wherever the culture takes us, which in this case is into secularism and faithlessness. And
see, I'm a Catholic. I like my church old school. Frankly, I have a problem with a lot of things that the Pope says, because he seems to be, I opposed gay marriage, not for any reasons other than I didn't like the idea of redefining what a word had always meant based on the political whims of the moment.
Sure.
Because then no word can technically eventually mean anything.
Yeah.
You have that same thing with faith a lot of times, and you find that in places like the United States, where we have it relatively good. We aren't being hunted down. We aren't being ostracized, fired from our jobs, thrown into camps, executed on the streets like they are in other parts of the world. And faith becomes, and religion becomes, something you kind of take for granted when you have it too good. In that sense, from a spiritual sense, in the health of the country, are we a victim of our own success?
Yeah, I think so. I think we are in many ways. I think it's Christianity. If you read the Gospels, it's about self-denial and sacrifice, and that's can't be avoided. I mean, the culminating moment in the Gospels, it's Christ's crucifixion, resurrection. It's all about sacrifice. And we're guaranteed that we're going to face pain and suffering. So given that that's such an integral part of, supposed to be such an integral part of the Christian experience, and then you live in a country where there's just comforts all around, and it's very easy to live, if you want to live a life avoiding suffering. You can live your life not even thinking about your own mortality. I think it's one of the reasons why, you know, when a celebrity dies like Kobe Bryant, the reason why it affects us so much is that it causes us, at least for a moment, it's this sudden moment in the haze where the clouds part and we realize that, oh, we're mortal, actually. The death is a real reality for us. But most of the time we can live and not even think about it. We have the screens, you know, average American watches, he's looking at screens for 10 hours a day, which is good for us. Yeah. You know,
hey, hi.
Yeah. this is a good screen to watch at this moment. But so it just, it's something that allows us to distract ourselves and numb ourselves, has this anesthetizing effect, I suppose.
Is there a way to combat that, really, honestly? Because the church, I remember, tragedy always brings people together. It drops the partisan divide, normally. I don't know that it would now, but it normally does. I remember after 9/11, the Friday after 9/11, 9/11 was a Tuesday, I went to St. Joe's on Capitol Hill for the National Memorial Service. It was, you know, all across the country. That there was not a place to stand in there. You go back there the following Wednesday and you could lay down in the pews at the service.
Wouldn't be very comfortable, though.
No, not really. But religion does have appeal to people, but we don't, a vast majority of people who even do believe, maybe don't have faith, but do believe, leave it right. It's very casual. It's like a summer shoe. They use it when they need it, and then they forget about it so easily. And part of it's on the church. The church has to find a way to get them in. You talked about the that the churches are afraid to address what you address in the book for fear of alienating some of the people who do show up. And I don't know, how does the church sort of rectify this? Because the world is definitely a better place when church was a bigger factor in people's lives.
Yeah, I think any societal indicator that you look at, that holds true. The interesting thing, you talk about the casual experience of faith. The problem is when things are so casual, and when the church experience reflects the secular culture so much and apes it, copies it, then there's no reason to be there. It's just people feel like, why am I even here? Right. I'm getting the same thing I will anywhere else if I turn on the TV. No one here seems to be taking this seriously. What am I doing here? I might as well just stay home and sleep in. I think you need faith to be something distinct from the culture. People need to get something out of it that they don't get anywhere else. And the main thing people are looking for everywhere is meaning in their lives. If you don't have meaning, you know, you're left with despair. And especially when suffering comes as it always will, then it's hard to even keep living if you don't have meaning. The problem is that I think in many ways the church has abdicated this this mission of giving people meaning, and so now people are going elsewhere for it. That's one of the reasons why I think Bernie Sanders is so popular and socialism is popular, because people are finding meaning in it. It's a vehicle of meaning, and also Bernie Sanders, his message is a moral one. I don't agree with his message. Right. And I don't agree with his moral prescriptions.
I think it's couched as moral. I think he's doing that deliberately.
Right, of course.
Actually, yeah. I don't think he believes it's moral.
No, I don't think he does either. But that's the way it's packaged. And I think the churches should wake up and look and say, well, wait a second. All he's talking about is morality all the time. This is wrong. This is right. Young people are eating it up. Maybe there's something to that. Maybe we should be doing the same thing. And we have the real moral message with the real moral prescriptions that can give people meaning in their lives. So maybe we should start doing that again.
You made a point that it reminded me of. I've been in church many times where I thought I was watching MSNBC. I was being lectured about immigration and how immigration should be handled from a church perspective. And it's just, it is really one of those things. Why should I get out of bed for this? That thought does occur to you. But what do you mean by cowards? Explain what you mean by the cowards aspect of this. Because if somebody just read this title, they might think you're coming at it from a confrontational point of view. And in a way you are, but it's not the way I think that you could take this.
Yeah, well, and it is confrontational, so there's no denying that. And there was definitely discussion, you know, about calling the book Church of Cowards. Is that going to scare people away? Are they going to feel like I'm yelling at them? Which is part of my thing, I guess. I yell at people all the time, so maybe that's okay. But Church of Cowards, first of all, I'm not just referring to. I think the easy thing to do when you talk about a Church of Cowards is to talk about the cowardice of the church leaders, to include the Pope. And, you know, your average pastors and priests in these churches who are afraid to engage with the culture, afraid to talk about, you know,
or go culture. Against the culture.
Right. And they are cowards. And I do talk about that in the book. But I think that's crowd pleasing. Most of us agree, you know, anytime you're pointing somewhere else and saying, look at those cowards.
But you have a bigger.
Right. Point. I think the people in the pews, I think me, you know, all the rest of us, we also have become a part of the problem of cowardice. In that, we want to avoid suffering. We want to avoid submission. You know, things like submission, obedience, reverence. These are scary words to us now. We don't like it. We don't want that. We want to create our own version of Christianity. We want our own Jesus. People talk about my personal relationship with Jesus. Nothing wrong with that in theory, but I notice when people say it, oftentimes they emphasize the my. They say, this is my personal relationship with Jesus. And what they mean is, I'm calling the shots. I'm the one who I lead the relationship. I'm going to decide how this is going to work. When really, if you're going to say that phrase, I guess the emphasis should be my personal relationship with Jesus. You know, it's like that should be the emphasis here. But I don't think that's
really. There really a lot of it in this country has evolved into like the Golden Corral of Christianity, where you take your plate up there and you pick what you like. Yeah. I don't want broccoli. Forget broccoli. I don't care what they have to say about this particular sex before marriage. Give me more of that. Aaron, you keep the no sex before marriage thing over there. It's difficult to counter. It's almost impossible to counter in a society where complacency is almost looked at as a virtue. I mean, for God's sakes, you can get anything you want. I'm on Amazon. I'm looking at your Amazon page right now. I could order basically lunch and have it delivered here in an hour. There is the idea of sacrifice in our daily lives, in our physical being, is foreign, almost stamped out in this country. So when it comes to spiritual lives, sacrifice is very important in our religious lives, and putting others before us, particularly, you know, the family. How do you counter what the culture is literally hammering into us as a virtue?
Well, and I think you said, you know, we've dressed complacency up like a virtue, and I think we have. But we use different words for it. So we use words like tolerance, acceptance, those kinds of words. And those are the great, in our culture now, those are the great virtues, to be tolerant and accepting. Well, the interesting thing about tolerating and accepting things is that you can do that from your couch. If you sit there covered in Cheetos dust.
I'm really good at that.
Right, me too. I could tolerate stuff all day long. Just sit there and who cares? But that's why it's not a real virtue. There's nothing, there are things we should tolerate, but the actual virtues are ones that require something of us. We're doing something. Compassion, you know, this is a word that's been cheapened and it's become a synonym in our culture for things like acceptance and tolerance. But really, compassion means, if you break it down, the etymology of it, it means co-passion. Passion is suffering. It's co-suffering. So if you're really compassionate, you're suffering alongside someone. That's why Christ is the ultimate example of compassion. He suffered for us, which is what we're called to do on a smaller level. But that's, you know, these are the deeper meanings of these words. I think that's what the church should be providing, is a deeper understanding. We don't want the superficial, surface level stuff. Maybe on some level it is what we want because it doesn't challenge us. But then in our core, we're left empty and hungry. So I think that's what the church has to do, is provide the meaning that people are really searching for. And it's interesting to me, you know, the churches that I go to, this is, you know, anecdotal, but in my experience, the churches that I go to that are really vibrant, alive, full, energetic, young, most of the time are the conservative Orthodox churches. I go to a Latin mass, you know, young families all over the place. Whereas if you go to some of these more secular looking churches, it's old, it's bored, there's nobody there. So it does work. If you give people that deeper sense, they will show up.
What do you say to somebody who's listening to you and listening to us talk and is giving us an amen, if you will, but they go, I like what you're saying. I agree with what you're saying. But if I step beyond my comfort zone, I could lose friends. I could alienate some people. It would make my life more difficult. Is that really what God wants me to do? I'm being called to make my life more difficult, to maybe alienate my coworker or my boss, my neighbor. The go along to get along ideology is a siren call to a lot of people. Why not just let somebody, the tolerant aspect of it. Tolerance used to mean you leave me alone, I'll leave you alone. We'll just disagree or agree to disagree. I don't care what you do as long as you don't care what I do. Now it's tolerance means celebrate what I do or you're a hater. And people don't want to deal with that. So they avoid discussions of religion. They avoid public displays of their faith, yet they want to. So if you have it, you have it. It's with you. It's not something that you pick up Sunday morning, pack up in your nice clothes and go to church. It's with you all the time, even if you only really show it that 1 hour per week. You're calling for a wake-up call here. What should that person be doing? What do you think that person should, what do you do in that situation?
Well, and I think we can all relate to that. I feel the same way. It feels better to be liked by people, to be admired and everything. Nobody likes being hated.
It's easier to go, I'll just keep quiet about this.
Right, exactly. So I totally understand that. And I also understand, I think it's important for us, people like us, especially, to acknowledge that, you know, people say to me sometimes, oh, how do you have the courage to speak out on these issues? It actually doesn't take courage, because this is my job, and this is what people expect me to do. I get paid to do it. If you live if you have a normal job and you go to an office, for you to speak out, I think it takes a lot more courage, because you could lose that job. You could, and so I understand that, and I have respect for that. But we just have to remember that if we try to go along to get along, as you say, and be liked and admired and take the easy route, we can do that and we can coast along, but that's all we're ever going to get out of life. It's just, that's it. That's what life is going to be. It's just going to be coasting along with little resistance. We're not going to find anything deeper in our lives. It won't be satisfying. And people aren't satisfied in our culture. If you look around, depression, suicide, drug abuse, people are taking the easy way, but they're finding that there's nothing in it and they're still very unhappy. So,
but in many ways, government, thanks to the left, has replaced religion. Yeah. Climate change is the religion, government is the God. And that leaves people feeling empty in a lot of ways, even emptier than I think atheists feel. I was friends with Christopher Hitchens the last 3 years of his life. And we didn't talk religion an awful lot. But on occasion, he'd say, I have to cancel, where he would go to temple with Jewish family members. And he'd go, don't give me any crap about this. I was like, I know. There was no more famous atheist on the face of the earth. But he was... while he didn't understand it, it was different from Bill Maher's atheism, where Bill Maher's Christopher was like, if you want to talk about it, I'll talk about it. It doesn't define me. And if you want to try and convince me, go ahead. You won't do it. I was willing to engage in anybody who was interesting. Bill Maher, when he finds out that if you aren't an atheist, he starts ridiculing you, belittling you. And that's part of a sign of the culture, that the whole culture has kind of moved in that direction because the left controls the culture. Just in that context, in this world that we live in 2020, what caused you to want to write this book? What was the spark? What was the thought you had that you said, you know what, this isn't an op-ed, this isn't a monologue on my podcast. This is 200 plus pages of deep thought.
Well, because I'm as troubled as everybody else is when I look at the state of Christianity, and I see, we talk about the 80% figure, whatever. It's actually much, and the percentage of Christians now is less than it was, and it's trending downwards. But it's actually, the situation is much worse than that. When you look at any survey or study, you're going to find that the number of Christians who actually will affirm basic doctrinal tenets of the faith is shockingly low. And so we all recognize this. I think any Christian is troubled by it. And I know that I am. It's something that takes up a lot of my thought, especially because I have four kids. And so I'm worried about the culture that they're inheriting and preserving their faith and getting, helping to get them to heaven. So I wanted to, I don't think there's any more important issue to discuss, really. And so that's why I thought it was worthy of a book.
When somebody's reading Church of Cowards, what do you think is going to cause them to get angry? There's going to be something in here. This is too, the topic alone will go, I agree with that. Wait, he's wrong about this. Is there something in there that's going to go, this makes me uncomfortable?
I mean, hopefully the whole book. I mean, I hope that people have part of that reaction. That means that they're engaging with what I'm saying and thinking about it. I think there are parts of the book that might make people feel sort of personally attacked, because, as I said, I'm not focusing just on maybe what people expect, is focusing on all the cowardly leaders of the church and everything, and the Joel Osteens, and yeah, he gets some mentions, but I'm not just talking about that. I think people are going to feel like, hey, well, you're coming after me personally.
And you don't think God wants him to have a Lamborghini?
I when I look at the Gospels, I see Jesus all over the place warning against obscene wealth, and it seems to me that profiting off of preaching the gospel is not what Jesus
wanted. That always bothered me that people make a lot of money off of
it. And not just make money off it, but when they say that if you have a lot of faith, you'll be rewarded with material blessings, that's what the prosperity gospel is, that is just an odious heresy, in the exact opposite of what we're told in the gospel. And then, of course, it makes people feel like, well, I'm not rich, so I guess there's something wrong with my spiritual life. I'm not praying hard enough. And it causes us to look at, you know, homeless people in the street and think, well, they must not be good Christians. You know, that's the message, even if it's not set out right. It's really horrible.
Across the country, there's been the rise of the mega churches, though, that I view kind of as that way. There's one not too far from here, not naming it, but you can probably find it on Google. Where they have a Starbucks in there. It's like a business. It's more like a party than a church. Are you of the belief that whatever gets people in the door to have a shot at getting them is good? Or is there that makes me uncomfortable. I think it's, first of all, an impersonal experience. It's a lot about marketing, more so the people on the stage than it is anything that they're saying. Because I'm reminded of the Righteous Gemstones TV show, which is kind of what makes me think of. But where are you on that?
Yeah, I'll never forget the time when I lived in Kentucky with my wife, and we went into a building. It's no joke, this really happened. We thought it was a mall. We were trying to go to a mall to get some jeans that I needed. And we walked in, because that's what it looked like from the outside. We walked in. It took a couple minutes to figure out this is actually a church. From the outside, you couldn't tell. There's nothing that said church or anything religious at all. You go in, and it wasn't immediately obvious. There was a little food court thing there, and
there's people a gap.
practically, and people at least looked like they had just shopped at Gap and walking around. And then we realized it's a church. I'm certainly not a fan of that either. I think that you want to get people in the doors, fine, but once you get them, what are you saying to them? You were bringing them in to what exactly? And if you're just bringing them into what a lot of these mega churches end up being is just a motivational, self-help seminar. If that's all you're giving them, well, you don't need to be a church, because people can go to Tony Robbins for that. And he's a lot better at it than most pastors are. That's the other thing is not the most important aspect of this, but the pastors that try to be self-help gurus, not only is that not Christianity, but they're not very good at it either. And you could get a better version of that from someone like Tony Robbins, or a lot of these church bands that try to be rock bands. It's not only is that not really Christian music, but it's not even good.
If I want
rock music, I love music. I'll go to a real band to get that. I don't want it from you. Give me something I'm not going to get when I turn on the radio. And that's what the church should be doing. People should walk in. It shouldn't take 2 minutes to figure out you're in a church. I think you walk in and boom, this is a church. I think the entire experience, the music, even, back in the old days, they used to use incense. They still do at some of the old fashioned churches. I like that. Yeah. Everything about it, just the entire experience. You come in, you're brought up into something, and you immediately know this is something different. This is has a sort of mystical flavor to it. And I think that's what church should be.
Yeah, the atmosphere envelops you, especially in a Catholic church. You set foot in there, there's the holy water, there's the candles, there's the organist always playing. So then would you believe, I guess is the word, is it better to have a small congregation of true believers or a large congregation of potential believers?
I would say definitely the former. And if churches start giving people real, not just junk food Christianity, but real Christianity, I think that in the beginning there might be a purge that happens where a lot of the lukewarm Christians in the pews say, I'm out of here, I don't want this, and they leave. And so your church is going to shrink for a time. And that's okay, because the ones that leave, they're not Christian anyway. It's not what they want. It's better for them to realize what they are now. We're told in Revelation, you're lukewarm, I'm going to spit you out of my mouth. It's better if you're hot or cold. So I think it's better to take those lukewarm Christians, turn them cold. If you need, turn them off completely, piss them off, fine. Make them confront themselves and their own beliefs and realize who they are. You shrink down to the hot, the hot water, as it were, the ones that are really on fire with their faith. Now you have a core of something, you know where you stand, and you can build out from there. And I think that churches that have done that have discovered that that's exactly what happens. at first there's a shrink, but then now that now you've started with that core of real believers and you build from there, you have a young, vibrant church again.
I know my audience, and there are a lot of people who would be giving an amen to what you're saying, and then there are a lot of people who are uncomfortable. Just they don't like to be preached to, preached at, or depending on how they take it. And I imagine you deal with that on your show a lot because you are very opinionated. We're paid to be opinionated. But when it comes to politics, people accept that. They expect that. They come for that, actually, in politics in a lot of ways. Religion, it seems different. Why do you think that is? And what would you say to somebody who's sitting there going, "This, who the hell is this? Tell me I'm not a real Christian." I imagine you write a book like this. You talk the way you do. You get that a lot. I can't address that. I'm just not that way. But how would you address that?
Yeah, well, you certainly – look, anytime you start talking about moral issues, even if it's not in the context of religion, you're going to get automatically, as a reflex, some people are going to say holier than thou, self-righteous. Mm-hmm. It's just a reflex that people say. And it's a way of shutting down the discussion because they're uncomfortable. And so I know that going in. I think first of all, it's hard to defend yourself against the charge of being self-righteous without sounding self-righteous, right, sort of by definition. But what I will say is, self-righteous, holier than thou, preachy. When I think of that, I think of someone who's saying, "Be more like me. I'm perfect. Let me put myself up as an example, and all of you people can follow me." That's
it's
a self-righteous.
Like you read my mind.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that's not what I do in this book. That's not what I do in general. I actually have a very low opinion of myself. I think there are examples we could follow. It's not me. I'm approaching this as someone who's down in the muck also, and as one of the cowardly Christians really struggling with my faith. And here are my observations. And it's more like I'm saying, "Hey guys, let's all together be better."
Well, that's the fine point I wanted to put on it, just in case there be any confusion out there. Because this isn't a book for if you don't fit into this square. It's not for you. It's not, this is a very, it's a broad book. It's a broad concept book. When somebody, and it's not just you're a true believer or you're going to hate it. It's a book to make you think. So Matt Walsh, and along that line, as a book to make you think and reevaluate yourself, as somebody reads the last page of Church of Collards at night and going to bed that night, what's the thought you want them to wake up with? What is it that you want them to stick in their craw that the not even the central idea, but the one thing that might haunt their dreams or change their lives?
I guess if there's one word or concept that I'd like them to take away, it's authenticity. To be an authentic Christian, to actually live the beliefs that we claim. I guess that's, and I have heard from people that have read the book, and that's kind of what they told me, is that they put it down and they feel now more inspired or on fire to actually live all these things that they say, which is exactly what I hope people take away from it. It's just a challenge to actually we say we believe all these things, and some of the claims we make as Christians are pretty extraordinary. So are we actually living that way? We talk about things like heaven and hell. There's an eternal life, and are we living with that thought always in mind? Are we living as if that's true? And I think many of us, myself included, are not. And if we look at, how we live, how we go about our day-to-day life, and we compare it to any, average secular person or atheist, we find almost no difference. Mm-hmm. So we're doing the same stuff and living the same way. And that just doesn't really make any sense when you think about it. If all the stuff we claim is true, that should radically alter everything we do. It should infiltrate every aspect of our life if we really believe it. And the question is, do we? And if so, then let's go forward.
That is the question. The book that'll get you down that road, Church of Cowards, A Wake-Up Call to Complacent Christians, available now. I'm going to ask Matt to sign these copies. And if you want to win a signed copy, you got to email me, Derek@dailycaller.com. If you purchase a copy, email me proof of it, you holding it up, not in a Barnes & Noble. That doesn't count. You got to be out in the real world at home, or a copy of your Amazon receipt. You'll be entered twice. Matt, congratulations on the book. Thanks for coming
in. Thanks a lot.
Appreciate it. That is all the time we have for today. I appreciate you guys listening, sharing, telling a friend, doing all that stuff. Click subscribe if you're watching the video. Stop looking for the subscribe button if you're just listening to the audio, because it's audio only and you won't find it. Have a great weekend. We'll be back here on Monday. See you then.
There you have it, the Matt Walsh interview. And if you want to enter to win a signed copy of Matt's book, you can email me, Derek@dailycaller.com, and you'll have a shot at that. Before we go, there is one thing I have to mention. I just have to mention. I mean, I'll talk more about Elizabeth Warren dropping out on Monday, because there's a great montage out there of and a whole bunch of female journalists and liberals are going, oh, it's just sexism. And even Elizabeth Warren played into that. It's just sexism that stopped her. No, she's a horrible candidate. She's a horrible candidate. She got all the glowing press you could ever ask for, and she couldn't do anything with it because she sucks as a candidate. I didn't make her suck as a candidate. Her uterus didn't make her suck as a candidate. She just sucks as a candidate. Nikki Haley, I would happily vote for her. But if you don't want to vote for Elizabeth Warren, you're a monster. But speaking of sucks, I just had to comment on this because we'll probably have the audio of it on Monday. It's just not out yet because it comes out on Hulu on Friday. I don't have Hulu, so I'm counting on somebody on social media to get the video and put it out there on social media. I know they will. But this story comes to us from the UK Daily Mail about Bill Clinton, the big Hillary Clinton documentary or documentary series or whatever the hell it is. To be honest with you, I haven't been paying that much attention, but this part caught my attention. Bill Clinton claims that his affair with Monica Lewinsky was one of the things, it was, quote, one of the things I did to manage my anxieties, end quote. That's all it was. He needed to manage his anxieties. Hey, honey, I'm feeling a little anxious over here. Why don't you come over and blow me? The former president suggested in an explosive documentary seen by the Daily Mail that he had the fling with the ex-White House intern while he was in office because it helped him with his own issues. Yeah, his own issue was he's married to Hillary Clinton, and he didn't want to go anywhere near that thing. So how about somebody else? That was the issue. Bill reveals that at the time he met Lewinsky, the pressure of the job made him feel like a boxer who had done 30 rounds. And he looked at Lewinsky as something that will take your mind off of it for a while. Good God. He looked at Lewinsky as, quote, something that will take your mind off it for a while, end quote. Wow, he's got to feel, Monica Lewinsky's got to just feel great. Monica Lewinsky's out there going, he loved me. We were in love. And now he's like, no, you were just a receptacle. You were just a, hey, you were willing. You know what? If I'd had peanut butter in a dog, I wouldn't have been in this situation. He makes the claim in an interview featured in the documentary series that will air on Hulu about his wife, Hillary Clinton, called Hillary, where the former First Lady and Secretary of State candidly reveals that in the aftermath of the scandal, the couple underwent painful marriage counseling. Yeah, I guess it's got to suck to come to terms with the fact that your husband would rather seek out an intern to relieve stress rather than remain faithful to you. Of course, this wouldn't be as devastating, or maybe it would be more devastating. I don't know. Ladies, you'll have to decide for yourselves. If this weren't the 10,000th in a string of unbroken receptacles. Maybe the governor of Arkansas's job is just wildly, wildly stressful and we just don't appreciate it enough. I don't know. But it doesn't really explain why he was doing what he was doing with everybody and anybody willing. I would like to get to the bottom of why he had such bad taste in women. I guess it was his child or a man-child of the 80s where big hair was the thing. But I will say this for Monica. She looks a lot better now, way better now. So good for her. But Bill Clinton, what a piece of trash. Bill Clinton offers an apology to Lewinsky in the documentary that will premiere Friday and says he felt terrible that her life was defined by the affair. Gee, how did you think it was going to end for her? How did you think it was going to end for her? Either she kept her mouth shut, then you wouldn't have never mind, or has to live with the fact that the president of the United States used her, or somebody finds out, and her life is, of course, going to be defined by that. She was a kid fresh out of college. She was an intern, for God's sakes. God, you talk about narcissism. You know, just when you think Barack Obama had the narcissism market cornered, Bill Clinton comes along and says, no, 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 wait a second. Wait a second. I got that one. I'm going to open my big mouth, or she's going to open her big mouth, or anyway, you never know. It just good lesson to everybody here. Keep your mouth shut. Just keep your mouth shut. Anyway, it is time, as you've all been waiting for. You didn't want to hear Bill Clinton blowjob jokes, but I thought they were necessary. The winners of the signed copy of Yuval Levin's book, and you will be receiving emails from me shortly or tomorrow or at some point. Now it'll be today because today's Friday. I'm going to pronounce the second one definitely maybe wrong. I don't know. John Bayon, congratulations, you've won. And Nathan Geimenhart, I don't know. You know how you pronounce your name, and I'm sure you've heard it that way and 10,000 other ways just like that. Check your inboxes. I need your addresses, and I will send you off a signed copy of Yuval Levin's book. I wish I could give one to everybody, but that's just not the way the cookie crumbles. You will get another chance to win a signed copy. You do have another chance to win a signed copy next week of Church of Cowards, though, so you've got that going for you. Otherwise, go about your Friday, man. It's the weekend. What are you still listening to me for? What are you doing here? Go home. I'll see you tomorrow or Monday. Have a great weekend.